This is Asian Insider, and I'm Nirmal Ghosh. Now, Myanmar in 2011 went through a very promising transition to a hybrid form of government. It's a constitution which retains, gives the military a lot of power, but also has some democratic elements. So that was a transition in 2011. It was widely welcomed. But since then, things have, after a couple of years of optimism, started going downhill. Ethnic conflicts have resumed. There are new groups now that the Myanmar army is fighting, new groups on the landscape. There was the, in 2017 driving out of the Rohingya from Rakhine state. And in a few days, State Councillor Dr. Aung San Suu Kyi is going to be at The Hague to defend the government of Myanmar from genocide charges brought by Gambia. So it has been a bit of an unraveling of that project, which started with such hope in 2011. Now, into this comes a new book, The Hidden History of Burma, Race, Capitalism, and the Crisis of Democracy in the 21st Century by Thant Minh U. Dr. Thant Minh U, who is, if you haven't read his books, they are required reading, and I would certainly recommend this book. Now, if you look at a country like Myanmar, often it is somewhat fuzzy, but when you read this book in particular, all the parts will come into sharp focus. That's what this book does. It is a wide sweep of Myanmar history and chronicling recent events. So we are fortunate to have Dr. Thant on the phone with us. Hi, Dr. Thant. Thanks for being with us today. Can you hear me?
Yes, pleased to be with you.
Okay, excellent. Wonderful book. I really enjoyed it, and I'm certainly recommending it to anyone who wants to understand Burma, and especially these last few years. It's very useful to have this kind of account. So thanks very much for doing that book. And there's one thing you mentioned in the book, in talking about the transition, and also at one of the talks you did in DC, I think it was the CSIS, you talked about sanctions. Now, sanctions was not really that significant a factor in the decision to, you know, make the transition in Myanmar from 100% military rule. But sanctions is now, again, back in fashion, of course, in D.C., right? Sanctions and tariffs have been weaponized as foreign policy and as trade policy. And there have been some targeted sanctions on Myanmar, but there's talk of more as well because of the Rohingya issue and other human rights questions. But again, the old question, do sanctions actually work? Would they work?
I suppose, you know, it depends on the context, and it's possible in other contexts it might be useful, and it might be useful as a form of pressure during a diplomatic process. But what I can say for sure in the Burma context is that sanctions were not at all part of the thinking of the generals in their transition away from pure military dictatorship in 2010, 2011. That happened not because of pressure from sanctions or any felt pressure from sanctions, but instead from internal political calculations. And it was a move towards a constitution that the army had been planning for a long time. Anyways, this myth has kind of grown up, or at least has continued, that sanctions were and might continue to be a useful tool in terms of outside pressure to get Burma or the leadership in Burma to do things that it doesn't want to do. I think partly it goes back to the fact that in 2011, the country went from this pure military dictatorship to seemingly the sort of full light of democratic change. And people didn't really do their homework properly and think through and identify what were the drivers of change at the time. So people sort of fell into this easy explanation that sanctions might have been part of the picture. And I think we have to remember that, you know, what sanctions were on Burma in the late 1990s and 2000s, at a time when the country was trying to come out of its own quarter century of isolation. Mm-hmm. Sanctions reinforced that isolation, cut off Burma from the international banking system, and included some of the tightest restrictions on international aid, including international humanitarian aid anywhere in the world.
Would that kind of regime even be possible today? Because, I mean, the youth in Burma are so well-traveled, it's become sort of part of the global community again.
I mean, I think on the one hand, because Burma has come out of this isolation and because there are more economic links around the world, I suppose sanctions in a way would have even more dire consequences and would be felt by a broader section of the elite. So I suppose in that way, an argument could be made, and also because it is a more democratic country in many ways, that sanctions could pressure or put pressure on the political establishment. But having said that, I think we have to remember that this is a country and a leadership and an establishment that was very used to living in isolation, and I fear that, you know, it wouldn't make major changes to its policy approaches on key issues as a result of sanctions, and instead would just retreat into further isolation, or alternatively just a much greater dependence on the rest of the region.
Right, right. Another thing you mentioned in the book is the political economy, which has its roots actually in the colonial era, but it became the economy, so to speak. And now there are still sizable chunks of it left, and it is still thriving. And how does one take that into account? What does that mean in terms of understanding?
Yeah, I think that, you know, the politics of the country are relatively well known. I think even the ethnic and identity related, often violent conflicts are well known. But I think this political economy story is what's often quite hidden from the Burma picture. And as you said, you know, under colonialism, obviously, it was an extremely exploitative political economy that led to a left-wing reaction at independence, decades of different socialist and communist movements and parties and government experiments. Mm-hmm. But since the early 1990s, Burma has shifted into this very strange form of capitalism that has been intimately tied with trade with China, intimately tied to the ceasefires in the northeast of the country, often tied to illicit industries, including now a methamphetamine industry worth tens of billions of dollars, under army rule for most of that time. And I think it's still very much the economic system we have in the country. It's led to extreme inequality, unprecedented since colonial times. It's led to massive environmental degradation. I think it's led to rising economic anxiety. Mm-hmm. And I think in a way, this question of what should become of this economic system should be front and center of politics rather than something that's very much kept on the side.
Yes, you know, if you think of all these factors, it's actually a bit hard to be optimistic, certainly not as optimistic as we once were in the aftermath of 2011. And so the inevitable question, of course, is what about your ledger? Are you optimistic or are you pessimistic? And then we'll get to a second question, which you had mentioned earlier as well, which was climate change. Now, that is the big one, right, coming up the road. But let's start with your ledger.
Yes, I think that, you know, even in 2011, 2012, I think the mythology around the country went from Burma as this kind of darkest of dictatorships where nothing was ever going to change, this assumption that, you know, democracy, prosperity, and peace were just around the corner. And I think that there was, I think people didn't realize that, you know, after decades of isolation, decades of military rule, the political economy as it had developed is in the way that I explained just now, that the country was already facing almost unsurmountable challenges. I mean, one of the terrible legacies of the past couple of generations has been the systematic underfunding of education. And so the legacies of extremely poor education are extreme. I think, on the other hand, I mean, Burma is a country with tremendous economic potential, being next to some of the fastest growing markets in the region, with a young population that I think really wants to catch up with the rest of the region. Mm-hmm. You see thousands of young Burmese people setting up new companies, setting up civil society organizations that are extremely dynamic. But you these enormous challenges and this enormous potential next to each other, and it's very hard to know whether to be pessimistic or optimistic. I think if you add the issue of weak state institutions, then they are extremely weak institutions, and just the fact that, you know, we are now the poorest country in the region. When you open up borders in a country that's this poor and this weak, I think the dangers of a sort of populist or nationalist backlash are also something that we have to consider or think about as well.
Right. And Burma is one of the countries most at risk, actually, from climate change, right?
I think, you know, for a much richer country, even a slightly richer country in Southeast Asia, like Thailand, I think it might be possible to cope with some of these things. But for a country as poor as Burma, in the state that it is, with conflict, with poor state institutions or weak state institutions, I think it's going to be really tough to see how it's going to be able to manage over these next 20, 30 years what is almost inevitably going to happen in terms of climate change.
Yeah, you mentioned the weak state institutions. That goes back to a question I was hoping to have time to ask, which is, pre-2011, at least the army was the institution. It was the state. And, you know, so many people worked for the army in some capacity or the other. It was the only institution really that mattered and dominated the landscape, and all the other, the sort of bureaucracy, parts of the bureaucracy kind of atrophied. Is there any evidence of the normal institutions of government now sort of developing, evolving, and gaining some credibility?
There are new institutions on the scene. I mean, there's the National League for Democracy, which was in opposition and locked up, but now is thriving in a more open political environment. There are other political parties. There are hundreds of CSOs. The bureaucracies themselves, though, are relatively unchanged. I mean, we have to mention also another big institution in the country, which is Facebook as well, which is all powerful in many different ways. But I think what's important to point out is that even though the army was all powerful politically, and even though it weakened other state institutions, I think in a way what became even stronger over these past 20, 30 years have been these networks around the political economy, these networks of money-making, of business, of rackets around illegal economies as well, which in some ways are even stronger than the formal institutions. And I think when we look at Burma, we have to think in terms of these networks around money making, which are so paramount now in terms of what is actually animating the country and shaping day-to-day life, than any of these state institutions or even civil society institutions as well.
Okay, really interesting. Now, one last quick one. You've often sort of referred to Burma as a place where, of course, we know where World War II almost didn't stop. I mean, we know that it's been, you know, and there's not been a single day without conflict, I think, for decades in Burma, right? But one thing you said at one of your talks, I think, was that Burma always seems to be a country on the verge of becoming a failed state, but never actually does. It sort of continues. Somehow there is some dynamic that keeps it going with all these various conflicts in the borderlands and so on and so forth. So I wonder what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I mean, on the one hand, this is a country that hasn't known peace since really World War II. We have a country or a landscape where maybe a third of the country is dominated not just by army, but by many different ethnic armed organizations and hundreds of different militia, especially in the Northeast. We have these multi-billion dollar illicit industries like methamphetamine production and trafficking. We have identity-based conflicts, weak institutions. So you wonder, you know, why isn't this country, despite the Rohingya violence and the intensity of the armed conflict, sometimes we have to wonder, you know, why isn't the country actually more violent? You know, are we on the cusp or on the brink of a sort of failed state scenario, or is something really holding this country together and we don't really see the ingredients of that? And I think at least part of the answer revolves around what I mentioned before, that the state institutions themselves are very weak, but these networks around money making have grown up organically over 25 years. They cross every ceasefire, racial, ethnic, religious line, and may actually be part of the glue that's binding the country together in some ways. But I think we're just at the start of really understanding what is a huge part of, again, what is shaping the landscape today.
Okay, great. Dr. Tan, thank you very much. This is the book. Here's the book again. Here's the book again by Dr. Tan Mint U. Be sure to get it if you want to get a really clear picture of where Myanmar has been at these last few years, especially, and what may be in store. Myanmar is again experiencing a number of crises, and it is very important for the peace process, for one thing, to get going and for a resolution to be found to the long-running Rohingya crisis, the Rakhine crisis. For Asian Insider, I'm Nirmal Ghosh.